Have you ever had anybody say to you, you can't do it? You weren't talented enough, you weren't capable of it. Or maybe you've run into some problems in your career and you've had some real roadblock happen, like an injury or something that really seemed to be the end of the road. Well, I'm going to be talking about how you deal with that today with my guest on the 17th episode of The Kathy Keith Show. Welcome back. So I'm really excited today about this particular episode. I'm going off script a little bit. And the person I'm talking to today is an award-winning, multiple award-winning, I don't have enough time on the podcast to tell you all the awards he's won, an award-winning Scottish fiddler by the name of Ryan Young, who's up and coming in the fiddling Scottish traditional fiddle world. And he's just an amazing person, might be the kindest, most humble person I've ever met. He is on the show today, and I'm so excited to have him here. He's had a lot of really interesting challenges in his career that we got talking about this summer. And one of the things I really want to do with this podcast is not only bring you ways of improving your dog sport performance, but help you understand that the path to success is very parallel no matter what the discipline is that you're in. But often there's an echo chamber in your own particular culture, in your dog world or your dog sport or whatever it is you're in. And it can be really helpful to listen to people outside of your sport or whatever discipline it is to give you new perspectives on things, different ways of thinking about things. That's what Ryan and I want to do today. I got talking to Ryan this summer and we got talking about things like adversity and authenticity and passion and perseverance. And I thought it would be a great podcast just to take a different look into a different world and how these same types of things happen and how other people deal with them. So, Ryan, I'm so glad that you're here today. Just to start out, I kind of want to set the stage because you and I met at Leahy Camp, at Fiddle Camp this past summer. And one of the things that really struck me about what you were saying, you said this multiple times, you kept really emphasizing that beyond technical skill, you really wanted everyone to have their own voice. If at the end of camp you achieved anything, it was that everyone was developing their own voice. And it kind of struck me as I heard you say that, I thought, this is a guy who really cares about authenticity, about the technical stuff matters. And then when we kind of talked afterwards, we were talking about that balance of trying to do things right and also try and be authentic. What started you with the idea of why are you so passionate about everyone having their own voice? Why is that so important to you?
Well, I think for me, just the best music you'll hear is the one that's got real kind of life experience in it. It's like people trying to say stuff without words in a way. And everybody has their own story. Everybody's been through things that are unique to them and like seeing the world in their own unique perspective. So it's kind of like, I feel you should play a tune like that because everybody sees it and hears it differently. So I think that's like the beauty of music. I have no idea what the note G sounds like to you because you only
usually
hear it in
out your
of
head. Tune.
That's like the beauty of the fiddle, actually. Intonation. It's a very personable thing. It's like coloring of a note. And is it really out of tune if that's how you hear it?
Well, to me, it sounds great, especially after a glass of wine or two. But one of the things I found really interesting about that idea is the same thing actually applies to sport as well, because a lot of my people are dog sport people and different stuff like that. And often what I find, and I get caught in this too when it comes to my music, I get so caught in trying to do it right, trying to make the intonation right, trying to bow it the right direction.
Yeah.
It sounds horrific because I'm not even listening to the music anymore. I'm just trying to like saw out something the way somebody told me to saw it out. And I find the same thing happens for people in sport or anything else. You get so hung up in trying to do it right that you completely lose yourself.
Yeah, it's like trying to remember why you're doing the thing. Because you're not doing it to be perfect. You're doing it because you enjoy it. And you're doing it because it does something for you.
So how did you find your voice originally? What was that kind of path for you?
Well, it was like a mixture of things like traditional music is a big thing in Scotland and Ireland, of course, but not in the area where I'm from. So if you said you played the fiddle, people would kind of be like, you play the what?
Really? Even in Scotland?
Yes. There's bits of Scotland where people just do not care for it, really, I suppose. But I always loved it. And my dad used to play blues at home. that was kind of the only music I really heard in the family home. It's like people playing blues, like bending notes on the guitar and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discovered later in life that I have something called synesthesia, which I didn't know was a thing. For anyone who doesn't know what that is, I see notes in colours, which kind of linking back to the intonation thing, it's like you can see a note through shades of colour rather than it being like an absolute colour sort of thing. So like the note G doesn't have to be a solid green. You can play it slightly out of tune for a different shade. So it was kind of like just embracing those two things. And my mum's an artist. She paints. So I would try to play a tune in the same sort of way she might play with colour.
Oh, really?
So it was largely the family background. My dad in the blues and my mum in paint.
So how did you end up with a fiddle in your hand as opposed to like a blues guitar?
When I was in primary school, elementary school, I suppose, for any North American listeners, the violin was the only instrument that was offered to us. And I had no idea what a violin was at the time. It was just, it was offered and I said, I would like to do it. And I was so quiet at school to the point where some of the teachers had never heard me say a word.
Really?
And when I went for this violin audition, they said I was too shy and too quiet and the violin's probably not for me. And then I sang a song to the lady and it's the first time she'd ever heard me say anything and she decided that I could play the fiddle. But that was classical violin lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't take to it really in the way I hoped I would have. And then I heard a man called Ali Bain playing the fiddle as opposed to the violin. And something about the way he played, it was just a very kind of personal sound. Like it was immediately recognizable that's him playing. And it felt like it came from somewhere within himself. And I just thought, I love the idea that you could speak through an instrument without words.
That's so cool.
That kind of got me hooked on it.
Oh, that's really cool. I think that happens for so many people. You know, they're kind of trying this, they're trying that. And then all of a sudden, something just grabs them. It's like, that's it, that grabs them. And there's a researcher, I think it's Angela Duckworth, who talks about grit. And grit is, by her definition, the combination of passion and perseverance. That's her definition of grit. And I have found that anyone who ever gets to a really high level of anything, they obviously have a huge passion. A friend of mine once said that he had perfect pitch. He was a musician. And he said he always got so mad at people when they said he was naturally talented because he didn't just come out of the womb that way. He had to work at it so hard. Still, even though he had this one particular gift, he still had to work at it so, so hard. And I think that something that people don't always understand is even though you might have some element that gives you an aptitude towards it in some way, there's that passion that's got to ignite. And then there's the perseverance that you have to still have, even if you have some element of talent to go with it. So you've had some challenges over the course of your career, I understand.
Well, yeah, I had a lot of people tell me when I was younger that I would never be any good at it, is one thing.
Did you really?
So I auditioned for a big music school. It's one of these places where it's like a residential place where you do music and your kind of secondary schooling. When I auditioned for that, the then head teacher basically took me aside and said, I don't think music is something that you should continue with.
Are you serious? Really?
But like, I was a very kind of shy and quiet child. And a lot of people thought that would have like broken me and were very surprised that it spurred me on to actually do it. So that was one of the first hurdles. It was a lot of people saying that you're probably wasting your time.
So let's jump on that for a sec, just before we go on, because I love that already. I mean, I'm just like, I love stories like this. So many people do get crushed by that. Were you in a situation where it was like, well, just because they said I can't, now I'm going to? Or was it you were that passionate about it? Or what got you over the hurdle? Because surely for a moment you must have gone, well, maybe I can't. Or did you never even have that thought?
Well, I'm not too sure. When I was little, I used to play a lot of badminton as well. And it was kind of getting to the point where I had to choose between the fiddle or badminton. It was just too much to do both.
That's kind of a random thing.
Yeah. My poor parents, I'm one of like four children, so like they're constantly taxiing us here, there and everywhere. They just didn't have the time in the day to take me to badminton tournaments or music camps and then take my two sisters and my brother somewhere.
Right.
So it was like, you need to pick one. And then they thought after that, I would have went, well, it's going to be badminton then. But I don't know why it was the music thing. Sport, badminton, it was just, I didn't like the idea that there's like a definite winner of something. Whereas like I like the idea that music is more subjective. And it's like how you quantify how somebody feels if it comes out in expression.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can't say that's better than that sort of thing if it's just an expression of a person.
Right.
It felt like it was like the less stressful option. She didn't need to worry about winning. You were winning just by being true to yourself whomever you played.
What's interesting about that, I find, is that's part of the problem in sport, is people quantify it by winning. But I find that the people who do get to the very top, sure, they're driven to win, but they're driven to be the best they can be. And the winning kind of, on some level, once you reach a certain point, becomes a byproduct of that. And I think it's the same for a lot of things. But the problem is most people are focusing on that outcome of winning. And so they get so hung up in that, or they lose their confidence over it, or whatever it is, that then they don't focus on that process of getting better. So I'm still curious what sort of ended up making you go the way of the fiddle.
I think it was just this idea that if I just played what I believed in, then that was me winning every time.
Yeah, oh, that's cool.
As soon as I strayed away from what if I played something just to please somebody else, I'd feel like I was doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, oh, that's cool. What was the next big hurdle you faced?
Probably the biggest hurdle was fairly recently in my life. My left hand kind of stopped working.
Just out of the blue?
Yeah, I didn't really understand what was happening with it. And coincidentally, it was round about the time of the first lockdown as well. So There was already a challenging time. And then I didn't have music to keep me sane anymore.
Wow.
Essentially, it was like my ring finger stopped being able to move it, really. And there was lots of investigations and lots of misdiagnoses and lots of, it's all in your head, there's nothing wrong with you sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, a surgeon operated on me and discovered my tendons were stuck in the little tunnels they go through. And it was just because of the natural structure of my physique. And basically, they cut free my tendon and it seems to be better again. But I do have to put my little finger behind my ring finger now when I want to move it, just because of the way that they share a tendon and stuff. I relearned how to play in some ways.
Wow. I did a little bit of research before the talk. I was chatting. So that was between your first and second album.
So it was like just before I recorded my second album, really. I actually did record it with this problem going on. And then I went and had the operation and then went back and did it again. And then I recorded it a third time, and that's the one that exists.
Oh, wow. So that one's Just a Second, right?
Yeah, it's called Just a Second.
You've put out your first album. It's got all kinds of critical acclaim and you're like rising. And all of a sudden, the pandemic hits and your hand craps out on you, basically.
Yeah.
That's got to seriously mess with your head.
Well, it does, because playing the fiddle was my whole sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
That's like everybody knew me as when I was little. It's like, that's the little boy that plays the fiddle.
Mm-hmm.
And I was kind of having to accept this potential reality of like, that's not me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If I can't do it anymore. And it's like, well, I'm going to have to find a new identity in some ways. I just wasn't prepared to let that happen because I was told so many times, you need to stop. And I never stopped.
So for as quiet as shy as you seem to be as a youngster, you have a definite sense of determination in there somewhere.
Oh, yes. It's just like when you're so in something and then it's taken away from you, you realize even more how much it means to you. And how much that thing kind of completes you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, even if I had to lose a finger or whatever, I'd still find a way to play because I'm not me without it.
I know of a piano player who did that. I can't think of the name offhand, but it was like a concert pianist who lost two fingers in an accident or something like that and ended up still doing their thing. So when you went through that phase, did you just kind of not accept defeat in the sense of, did you just keep looking for answers of ways to fix it? Or did you even start thinking about what else would I do? Did you have any doubts at all? Or did you just kind of stay laser focused on, I'm going to fix this?
I stayed kind of focused on wanting to fix it. I think largely because prior to that happening, I left music school and tried to get like a normal job, not a musician job.
A real job.
And just nobody would employ me. I wouldn't even get an interview for anything. I was just like unemployable. Then I went back and did a master's degree just to avoid growing up for a little bit.
I get that. Been there.
So I think just that experience of like, well, I couldn't get a job outside of music. So like, it's kind of this or nothing is what it kind of felt like.
Sometimes I find it really interesting how literally that rock bottom kind of moment gives you so much clarity, even though it can be terrifying to be there in the moment. But one winter I was dog training and I had a building I was going to use for my winter training. And then the building was basically said it was unsafe, can't use it. And in Canada, we have snow however deep. And I had to suddenly come up with a way to make a living. And this is way back. I mean, way back. And I thought, well, online was just starting up basically at that point. I put out a 16-week course of PDF lessons for people and put it on like a Yahoo group. Do you even remember Yahoo groups? I don't know.
No.
That's how old I am compared to you. And it really took off. And I thought, well, maybe online business is my way out of this whole kind of thing. And it's been fabulous for me, but I would have never even looked at that had this major disaster not happened to me. And so it's funny how sometimes these moments that just seem rock bottom can really be turning points, even in our either a new direction or a recommitment to the direction that we're already wanting to go. It like makes it really clear that's what we want to do. That's so cool.
Absolutely. One of the physios that was really helping me, he was very kind of spiritual about the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
He said, your hands are just a tool and music doesn't come from your hands. It comes from a place that can't be seen and your hands are just help you make that.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of love that idea. And I found it a very beautiful statement from someone whose whole career is around fixing people's tools.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
That is a fabulous statement. I absolutely adore what you just said, because everything that we do really comes from inside of us. And everything out here is all tools.
Mm-hmm.
And any way we go about things, we just have to figure out the best way to use the tools. So many people look at other people and they're comparing themselves because they don't have the same tools. And yet they can't actually be their best selves. Those tools wouldn't necessarily even make sense to them, or it wouldn't help them bring out what's inside of them in the same way that they think. So that's really interesting. So if your finger has changed a little bit from the surgery and so on, the way you use it, has it changed the way you express things or how you play things? Or sometimes constraints actually make you more creative.
I think so, because the way I dealt with it was that I kind of went back to playing tunes I used to play when I was a child.
Okay.
So it's like I restarted the whole process all over again.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately, though, as you were saying earlier, it kind of brings out like a deeper passion within you when it happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it actually since propelled me past where I had been. But just I felt like using kind of the same initial steps I'd taken many years ago was like the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And then if I compare recordings of myself now to recordings back then, you can still hear it's the same voice.
Right.
I don't think that it really impacted me that much because I'm still the same person inside. My physical ability to changing.
Yeah, I think that's so cool. And I think in sport, what happens quite often, you'll hear people say as they get older, like, I'm too old, I'm too slow now. You know, everyone has their I'm too something or other. But what's really interesting is like you've done, when they kind of lean into that and they go, well, I'm still me. Like I still know what I know and have the understanding that I have. There's often so many ways that they actually can be better because they just rethink how they're applying what they know. It's so interesting to me that you have been through all of this already. You know, a lot of us don't go through all of that several decades down the road.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that's made you more mature as a musician, having gone through all that?
I don't know if it made me more mature. I think more in the sense of, I don't know, it's just kind of strengthened my feelings for music in a way, in that like going through the worst possible things, it's still mm-hmm. unbreakable for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of the passion that I think can't be taken away. A lot of musicians, I know they kind of like, well, this has happened to me too, you kind of burn out eventually.
Sure.
When the thing you love doing becomes like a career, you begin to resent it in some ways. Whereas that's not really happened to me yet, just because of the idea that it was so close to being taken away. It's like I'm just going to hold on to it forever.
Yeah. So how do you deal with, this is kind of a different side of things. You may be one of the nicest, most humble people I've ever met in my lifetime. And I saw just recently you were playing, I think here in Ontario, and Natalie McMaster was on stage kind of listening. And you were like, oh boy, how do you handle stuff like that? Do you just kind of get in the zone and play, or are you nervous ahead of time, or how do you deal with stuff like that? Because you were saying that she was one of the people you listened to a lot as a kid and kind of was an idol for you.
Oh, she absolutely was. And she would be one of the people that my mum would be happy for me to put on in the car. So I kind of decided when I was quite young, because I never had like a vast technical ability at any point in my life. It's kind of fairly limited. But I decided quite early on that it's not really about me. It's about like the tunes, and like none of the tunes actually I've written them. They're all very old tunes. But essentially, like if somebody didn't play them, they're just going to sit there in a book being unheard. So if you kind of take yourself out of it in a way and just think, I'm giving myself to the thing I'm playing, then it kind of stops being about whether you're good at the fiddle or not. It's more about just you presenting the tune in the best possible way. And then you don't need to be nervous because it's not about me, it's about the tune.
That's a great way of thinking about it. As a matter of fact, I love that for even a lot of people in the dog sport world, for example. One of the things people often will say is, I feel like I'm not doing justice to my dog. But if you think of it from the way you've just said it in terms of, well, if you weren't out here doing stuff with your dog would just be doing nothing. So just by getting out there, you are doing justice to the dog. So that's a really neat way to think about it. And it kind of takes that ego out of it too, that it's about me rather than about either the tune you're trying to present or the dog that you're trying to show well or whatever you're trying to do. Is it kind of puts the focus where it should be? Because we never perform well when thinking about ourselves. We always perform well when we're thinking about the job in front of us, basically.
Yeah. With music too, though, like the person playing it, they become kind of almost like the audience in a sense too. Because you're also hearing the tune and you're playing something that does something for you. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of letting that tune do the thing it does for you, but like sharing it with other people. So it's kind of like you're like a vessel for the thing to flow through in a way. That's my favorite thing about music, is like just the kind of transporting thing it does to you. And you kind of get lost in it.
Yeah.
And when it stops, you're like, oh yeah, it's Thursday.
One of the things you and I talked about just really briefly, the idea of balancing this analytical, technical, like I'm trying to get stuff right kind of place you have to be sometimes when you're practicing, when you're trying to improve a skill versus trying to be authentic and let go. One of the things I find people have trouble with is they're usually one of two mindsets in the dog world, but in anything, I find this is true. They're either people who like to train and practice, or they're performers. So in the dog world, that would equate to the trainers and the people who like to handle the dogs. In music, that would be the people who really like to practice their scales and be really analytical, and the people who are like, ah, let's just go play. Right? Yeah. There's like these two ends of the spectrum. How do you balance those two things? Because I find people who are too analytical, they get stuck in it so far that they tense up and they lose focus during performance. And then the ones that perform really well, often their skill levels maybe aren't as high because they aren't focusing as well on skills. Just throwing that out there, how do you think about that for yourself, and what advice do you give people about that kind of stuff?
Well, I've always been very inspired by the Japanese idea of wabi-sabi. Mm-hmm. The idea, like, if a vase has a crack in it, in Japan, they will decorate that crack. Mm-hmm. And it's now that that crack is the thing that has made the thing perfect.
Yeah.
I love that idea that's like in music, if you were to play a note that was out of tune, it's like that out of tune note makes everything perfect. So it's like if you were too perfect, whatever perfection is, conventionally perfect, I should say, maybe, it's not perfect.
I find the word I sometimes use is sterile.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it, sterile. It's like hyper-realistic paintings. It doesn't do anything for me. It's like, well, you may as well take a photograph. I want to see what it is that you see.
Yeah.
So like if someone paints something, I don't know, maybe their perspective is a little bit off, but it's a lot more soulful and meaningful than this hyper-realistic thing that doesn't do anything for me.
That's a great example, because sometimes I think what happens with us in sport or in the dog world, I'll use the dogs as an example, but people want to have this perfect dog, you know, in the ring, but it's an individual and it has a perspective. And you have a perspective, and you get the best out of it when you understand the perspective, when you figure out that getting in the mind of that particular dog versus trying to make it perfect, where it becomes very mechanical and maybe doesn't work enthusiastically. Really, when you think about it, that same thing applies right across. You have a musician who's very mechanical, you know, all the notes are right, but you're like, you know, like,
yeah.
Nothing's going on. And then there's the people who move you and you just stop. I remember that at camp, like even during the concerts when you would play, or even in class, you would start playing and everyone would just stop because they were so captured by your expression and you're just so emotive when you were playing. It was just so real coming out. You just couldn't help but be transfixed by it.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, it was true. You know me, I'm always analyzing, but it was really interesting to watch because you would be transfixed by your playing and then I'd kind of pull myself out and look around and everyone else would be the same. It was just dead silent. And to me, that's the power of trying to not be afraid to be yourself.
Yeah. People are very vulnerable beings, like by nature. So I think it's just allowing that vulnerability to come through in whatever you do. Mm-hmm. And that's what's going to connect people, this kind of honesty. Because nobody's perfect. So the idea of like spending your life trying to achieve perfection is going against human nature, I think.
So what do you think about the difference between trying to improve weaknesses versus leaning into what you're really good at?
Well, I think I'm always trying to improve. I wouldn't ever say that.
Right.
It's more like, I wouldn't ever like just be like, oh, I'm good at this, so I'm going to avoid that. But I think it's more the journey of trying to get better at something can be a very powerful thing. Because it's like, you'll appreciate something a lot more if you work for it than if it's just there. So it's like certain tunes, like there's tunes I play in concerts and like I come out of it every time and I'm like, I still can't play that. But I'm going to try it again the next day. And it's just you get like closer and closer to whatever it is that is the problem or you want the tune to do or say for you. And it's kind of like, if I could just play everything exactly as I wanted, then there'd be no kind of searching within the thing.
Right.
And then it's kind of like, well, I feel like I'm missing something. Because I think sometimes in music, the most beautiful thing is hearing someone strive for something, but maybe not quite reach it. Whereas if they were just straight on top of it, it's not quite as emotive in some ways.
That's interesting. I heard another friend of mine who's a professional musician say something similar. And I didn't quite get it at the time, really, because the whole idea of it terrified me. But he said something about what really impresses me is when people get so far out on the edge, you're wondering if they can get back.
Yeah.
And I was like, that sounds terrifying. Not in sport for me. That I get it in sport, but out of context for me in music, I was like, oh my God, that sounds horrific. Interesting to listen to, but scary for me to try.
Well, it's just like going right to the edge of your ability and like playing something that's on the cusp of not being within your grasp.
Yeah.
I love that idea too. And I think like you tend to do it in a concert is where I think people do. I've always noticed this thing about like if somebody's really listening to you play, so there's this connection between you and them that brings stuff out in you that you didn't know you could do.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So maybe it applies to sport too. Like, I don't know, tennis or something. If like you went to hit a shot that you didn't think you could hit, but just in the match, you're like, oh, I'm going to go for it. And it suddenly comes off and you don't know how or why, but it just does.
I think that's super true of sport because, you know, when you're in the competition and everything's on the line and people are watching, you do, like you try and survive. You go for it, right? And you're trying to survive. I suppose it's exactly the same thing in music. Like when you have a level of competency and you're like, now I'm going for it and I'm going to try and survive and get out of this alive if I can.
You'll try stuff in the moment in a tune, like in a concert, and like the things you try might not always work, but you've got to make it work because there's people sat in front of you.
You can't say, can the band just stop while I go back and fix that?
Yeah.
We all wish we could do that in sport too, but it never seems to work out that way.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. The other thing I was going to ask you about was when you're talking about the idea of being at a big event or like a big kind of concert, when you're at a bigger event, do you still really try and keep that mindset about it's the tunes in front of me? Or do you get nervous for stuff like that anymore?
I get nervous every time I play, really. I get more nervous about the idea that I won't connect to the thing I'm playing.
Okay.
That it'll become a painting by numbers kind of thing, like going through the motions.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I get worried about. I worried about like not fully committing to the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter if there's like 7 people in front of you or 700. That's still the main fear.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes when there's a bigger audience, it's less scary. It's because there's less personable interaction with people because it's just a wash of faces.
Right.
Whereas if there's a room of 5 to 10 people, you can see every single one of them. So it becomes scary in a sense.
Yeah, that's actually true. I've never really thought of it in that sense. But yeah, I suppose in that case, it becomes more personal. And so there's that, to your point, real connection there.
Because when I used to play badminton when I was younger, if there was like a big crowd watching the match, you'd phase them out in some ways.
Yeah.
Whereas like if you were playing at school and there was just like 10 of your friends stood around you, you would feel every single one of their eyes watching you.
Yeah, that's actually a really, really interesting way of thinking about it. Because in competitions for people, a lot of times they get more nervous at the bigger events. It's interesting. I guess that's more maybe because there's something they really want, which is different in the sense that for you, you're always, because to your point, picking badminton versus picking fiddle, you're always going for your maximum expression and connection versus it's not a win-loss situation the way it is for people in bigger events.
Yeah.
That's interesting. The idea of burnout, let's talk about that for a sec. It is interesting you've had this, not a near-death experience, but career near-death experience, that's really given you a different perspective on playing. I've been in the dog world for well over 30 years, and I can't count the number of people I know who started out in it as either their hobby or whatever, and then they became instructors and they ended up getting burned out because it was both their career and, you know, they have to pay the bills and their hobby as well. So how do you foresee trying to stay fresh all the time? Do you ever step away from it sometimes and take a break? Or do you just right now you're on a roll and you're like, we'll just ride the wave while it's going here?
Well, it's the thing I'm learning more and more recently. Because I always had this dream that I would just live out of a suitcase and travel everywhere and just play music all the time. And in a sense, I did that 2 years ago. I played maybe over 200 concerts across a year.
Oh, my goodness.
I discovered that that's just too much. I didn't ever get fed up with the tunes I was playing or anything like that. But it's just kind of your mental freshness with it in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose just being mentally rested and physically rested, I've discovered such an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
Just, don't know, it's when it stops like kind of moving you in a certain sense and it starts to feel like a job, then I feel like something's not going right.
Yeah. I think it's interesting in the sport world, we actually try and plan for specific rest periods. Sometimes I do wonder I always am looking for crossover because I see so many people when they're successful, everyone follows these similar patterns of, you know, it becomes your career successful, they get burned out, you know, like it's the same cycle that we all go through. Also, I've been a seminar presenter over the years, and sometimes your star is up and everyone wants you, so you're trying to take advantage of that. And then sometimes you're on a lower swing. It is interesting trying to figure out how to balance that kind of lifestyle out. So you've got your new album coming out. When is that supposed to be coming out?
I'm actually going to be recording it in a month time.
Oh, wow.
So let's start recording it. So that's kind of my current stress at the minute. It's just trying to choose material for it. Well, that's one of the things I really struggle with is like I've got a month before I need to record this thing and actually committing to what I'll record on it now is just such a battle.
Right.
Because I would change it up until like 10 minutes before I do it if I could. Just the way these things work, you can't do that.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be difficult because there's those creative choices you have to make. You know, I find one of the things that's interesting for me is certain things have kind of a linear nature. Like the way you train a dog, you have to train the individual, but there's a certain linear nature to it. But when I'm writing or I'm developing new ideas for courses and, you know, things like that for my online business, you can get kind of frozen in trying to decide what your next step is. And even in the dog world, I know people can get frozen with not knowing what their next step is, or they get overwhelmed by all the choices or whatever. So I think that's something we all struggle with in some ways. How do you kind of go through that process? Do you kind of just, oh, well, this one sounds good. Yeah. How do you end up deciding?
It's so hard because it's all about how it makes me feel. And it's like you feel one way, you feel another way the next day sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you break it down further. It's even across the course of the day, something will feel good in the morning, but not at night.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of trusting that the way that thing made you feel will make you feel that way when you come to record it. And you've got 3 days to record it. So hopefully over one of those days then.
Yeah.
But it's like having options as well. I'll go into the studio with lots of different options. So like if that one just isn't feeling right, I'm not going to force it. I'll just try something different.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a producer for it. It's somebody I really trust. And basically they'll say that they feel I'm connecting to this the most or whatever.
Right. That's kind of almost like having a coach in a way when you're unsure, you have someone kind of look in on you and say, I think this will work better. I love the quote by Steve Jobs, and I'll probably butcher it a bit, but it was something about he trusted following the dots forward. He knew he wouldn't understand how the dots connected until the future when he could look back on how they connected. And I guess that's really the same process you're trusting, is you're following the dots. And then in the end, when you look back, you'll see how they ended up connecting.
Yeah. It's just a snapshot in time. This isn't me forever. I'm constantly growing as a person. So it's just a means of getting closer to the thing that I'm trying to achieve.
Right. That's a great way to look at it. Sometimes we want to make this perfect finished, there's that word again, perfect, perfect finished product, when really it is. It's a moment in time. That's a great way to look at it.
Yeah. Even if like you could ask yourself from 10 years ago what they thought, it might be quite different to how you think now, but you're still that same person.
Absolutely. Well, that has been so great. I'm just so honored you were here, Ryan, to talk and go through this, because I'm always so fascinated about people who do well at things. There's so much crossover in terms of how people get to be successful. So much of it comes down to that balance of skills and being authentic and trying to find the right balance for yourself at any given moment in your life, really, right? Because it changes all the time. And I just knew we'd be able to have an awesome conversation from even just our quick little chats at camp. Yeah. So if someone wants to find out more about your music and stuff, where should they go to? What's the best place to find you?
I have a website, www.ryanyoung.scott, but I'm also on Facebook and Instagram and all the usual places.
Fabulous. And any of those places are good to catch up with you?
Yeah, probably Facebook is the one I use the most, but any of them really.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Ryan, for joining me. I really am honored that you came on to have this talk. You had some gems in there that are going to help a lot of people.
Thanks for having me, Kathy. I was really delighted when you asked me.
Well, I just want to thank Ryan so much again for joining me in his incredibly busy schedule. I'll put links down below for you to be able to find Ryan's music and to make sure that you catch up with him on social media. And thank you all for being here. As always looking to try and do things better in our dog sports, in the way we approach life. And really want to push you to think about how you can apply these things both inside and outside of your sport. Because sometimes we do need to get outside of our echo chambers and see how it applies across. I'm always happy to hear from you for new ideas for topics or other podcast guests. And thank you for being here with me. I will see you in the next episode. Take care.